there are a lot of decisions you make in life, and you never know, you know, should I have done the other thing, taken the other job or gone to the other path. But I really believe if I follow this process and I'm true to myself, there's no way I can't succeed.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais. And the idea behind these conversations is to learn from people who are on the path of mastery. And this conversation is loaded. We're working to understand what they're searching for, how they understand the world, their craft, people, how they make sense of events, how they think about the future. And all of that is their psychological framework, which is really the basis for how they'll be able to approach difficult and challenging things. And then we also want to dig under the surface and be able to understand the mental skills that they've used to build and refine their craft along the way. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing. It just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this conversation is with Adam Shire. And if you have an iPhone or familiar with iPhones, you're familiar with Adam's work. He was the co-founder of Siri, and it was one of the first products that landed in cell phones that you could ask questions to the cell phone. Siri, tell me a joke. Siri, what's the weather? Siri. And you can go on and on. And, you know, when we talk about this, there's a humility that Adam has about Siri, and there's also a really rich understanding that he knows that there is so much more that Siri and other products that involved AI can do. And that's what brings us to this conversation, is he's also now the co-founder of Viv. And if you're not familiar with Viv, go check him out online. It's viv.ai. And the mission of the company is to radically simplify the world by providing an intelligent interface for everything. Now, anytime you've got the words the world and everything in a mission statement, it's obviously really big. But he understands how to work at scale. He's not just throwing those words around, series at scale. And when he thinks about how he organizes his life, he's got three verticals: goals for himself, goals for the world, and financial goals. And so one of the ones for the world is change.org. He was a co-founder of change.org. Go check that out as well. So this company, Viv, is electric. It's scary. It's wonderful. It's amazing. We talk about the complications that artificial intelligence has, and is it good for our future? Is it not so good? And he's so incredibly articulate. He's right at the pulse and at the center of what machine learning and artificial intelligence are about. So his point of view is really clear. Now, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. And it's loaded. There's pearls and wisdoms and gems that are sprinkled throughout this. So we've also created another podcast called Minutes on Mastery, where we take pearls and gems, the really rich stuff, and we just sliced them into 2 to 3 minute insights. So check out on iTunes Minutes on Mastery if you're looking for more of this stuff that it's more snackable, if you will. Okay, so this is a joy of a conversation. Let's jump right into it with Adam. Adam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Mike?
Yeah, I'm fantastic. Thank you for spending time out of your, I don't know if you're busy or not, but influential days that you spend. So I'm honored to have this conversation with you about your journey and as well as what you've come to understand from artificial intelligence and the challenges that the technology has and the gifts it also has for the world. And maybe some of the dark side, if we can get to there.
Sure, whatever you like.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so if the assumption is right, and I'll say it, you don't have to say it, that you're one of the tastemakers for artificial intelligence, like you really have influenced the field through your first product, Siri, and everything that spun from Siri. And what I want to understand what it was like early for you as we begin to build this inside of your story that has allowed you to become one of the most influential people in artificial intelligence. So we could go way back. You tell me when to stop, but like, what was it like early for you to paint the picture of the man you are now?
I guess I would start pretty early, maybe 10 or 11, and I was really interested in magic at that time, like lots of 10-year-olds are. And I think actually that fascination and wonder with the impossible and how the world works and what's possible and what's not possible and can you get around what you think is impossible by devising a trick or a secret, or can you bend the laws of physics, so to speak, through your brain, I think that led into a lot of what I do.
Okay, so 10 years old, a little kid interested in magic, yeah. And some kids watch magic and they suspend their belief system and like, wow. Some are more skeptical and they're trying to figure it out. And then you said, I want to actually do it and I want to take it further. So did you play with magic?
Oh yeah. So I get into things pretty heavily at that time. I only did it for a couple of years, but I read every book. I started performing. I would go get cardboard boxes from a department store and build illusions out of them and stuff my little brother into them, whatever it took. But, you know, my mom was never one to buy me things. I'd see, we got 1 hour of TV a week. In that 1 hour, I'd get a few commercials. I'd say, could I have that? Could you buy me that? She'd say, no, here's some cardboard and tape. Go make it.
Okay. And so, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Sharon, Massachusetts.
Okay.
East Coast.
And what kind of town was that?
It's a nice suburban, fairly diverse religiously town. You know, it has a beautiful lake. It used to be kind of a, 200 years ago when the country was formed, the founding fathers would go to Sharon to have their summer vacation. basically.
Okay. All right. So there's history there to that part of the world for sure. Okay.
Paul Revere built the bridge behind our house and the bell in the church in our center of our town, things of that sort.
How did that shape you?
I think, like I said, it was a small town. It was, you know, just not a lot going on. So to have fun, you had to invent it. You had to imagine it and create it. And I think that imagination, there weren't, I didn't have access to TV. Computers didn't exist. It was books and your imagination. And that's about it.
Do you have children?
I have one son, 16 years old now.
16. And how did you shape his beginning years with television? Did you do the same thing your parents did, or did
we were not as maybe as strict as my mom. Maybe that's a regret I have now. I've always emphasized, you know, consumptive versus productive behavior. But I think, like many of his generation today, you know, there are iPhones and electronics and TV. And a lot of that, comes, you know, it's so easy to sit there and just consume what's being thrown at you. I've tried to encourage the productive side.
And that's the productive side of TV or
productive
screens.
Means producing something. So you can, you know, if you watch a movie, I think of it as consuming the media. Mm-hmm. Someone else has built it and you just sit and absorb it. Productive is when you create your own movie and you get in a camera and you build it, or you write a book rather than read a book, or you write a computer game rather than play a computer game. And so it's more active versus passive.
Okay.
That's just my phrasing. But one thing which is interesting, when he turned 13, we discovered the box of magic tricks that I had left dormant for 35 years. And so one thing we can actually do together is magic rekindled, and we can actually, perform at kids' birthday parties or whatever. And it's a joy for me. And I think it's something that I can give to him to start creating and imagining and dreaming and performing and producing, in a sense. So maybe that's something I've given him.
Very cool. Okay. And so he's in high school now.
He is.
Okay. All right, so let's go back. You had one sibling or more?
I had a younger brother, 5 years younger, and then a younger sister, 5 years younger than him.
So you're the oldest?
I'm the oldest.
Okay, and what was your family structure like?
My mom stayed at home and gave us a lot of attention, which I liked. My dad, you know, worked. He was worked at one company his entire life, and was moved his way from low position up to a senior vice president in that company. He was in civil engineering and water treatment plants and trying a lot of environmental issues.
Okay. Middle class, upper?
I'd say middle, or, you know, somewhat upper middle class, you know, we were comfortable.
So I spent some time in heavyweight boxing, and it was really clear that the guard, if you will, the coaches and managers in heavyweight boxing, they had adopted the model that to create greatness or to create somebody who's a champion, it couldn't come from inspiration because it's too freaking hard to get in a ring with another grown person that's equally skilled and that's trying to hurt you. So it's inspiration or desperation. And they chose the desperation model. It was like apparent to them, like, you can't be great in this sport because unless you're desperate. And you would be a model of the inspiration, right? So it wasn't hard for you. And you took that baton that your parents had passed on to you, that were running as fast as they could, and they passed it on to you, and then you took it further. Mm-hmm. Does that seem as a fair assessment?
I think that's right.
And so how do you think about doing hard things?
So I have, when I got to college, there was a little bit of a transition. High school, to college was hard. And soon I started taking graduate classes, which were hard.
In undergrad?
In undergrad, yes.
Okay.
And by the time I was, a senior, junior, senior, I was taking all graduate classes. So at the end of the semester, I was faced with having, I'd take 6 classes or so. Every single one would have a 25-page paper to write, and or a computer program of substantial size, or both. And I was, you know, a little bit of a procrastinator, and I would be faced with this what seemingly insurmountable task. I have final exams, I have massive amounts of work, papers. I go, there's no way I'll make it through. And it seemed impossible. But at that time, and this has served me well, I would say, well, one way or another, time keeps moving forward. So even though I'm just 3 weeks away, nothing that whatever happens in 3 weeks from now, I'll be on the other side. So it seems like it's a wall that I can't get through, but actually time is marching ahead, and I will get to that point past that thing automatically. And that was helpful to me. And then I was like,
so that thought created space for you.
Yeah. Because you know what was hard, it almost made you seem paralyzed. Like there's no way I can do this thing. You could just freeze and say, it's impossible. Time has stopped. I'm going to fail. You know, I can't. And you could be stopped. But for me, somehow there was comfort in the fact that one way or another, I'm going to get to the other side. I might have failed, but 3 weeks, the clock keeps ticking. It'll get there. It seems impossible, but I'm going to end up on the other side. And that was comforting to me somehow.
Cool.
And then I would actually, you know, most people would say, well, where do I start? I started in a really odd place. So I had these six projects or papers or whatever. I actually started by not doing any of them, and I would go to the computer hall. I would think up something that I was excited or passionate about that had nothing to do with any of the others, and I would work on that. But I would work on it, and you're like, well, you have exam. What are you doing writing a chess playing program when you have or whatever? But I would get into this mode where I would get consumed with the thing that I was excited about, and it would kind of get me started. And I started living around the clock doing the thing that I love or was excited about. And then since I was like, I would eat, I would sleep, and I would work on this thing that was amazing and awesome.
And you knew you had this deadline.
And I had this deadline, and I had these six other projects. Hmm. And I would finish my thing, but now I was in it and I was working hard. And then I would just transition over. And I was in, and I had the habit of eating, sleeping, and being in the computer center working on this thing. And it was easy to transition over. And now I was working on the paper, working on the project for class. And I would literally, for 3 weeks, eat, sleep, and work. But I would kick it off by doing something that I loved. And somehow that combination of knowing I'm going to get to the other side, maybe I'll fail, maybe I'll succeed, seems impossible. But then I would get started, and I would get started with something that I loved and was easy for me to get started with.
Yeah. Wow.
And then I would just like flip it over, and now I'm in the mode, I'm in the groove, I'm doing it. And then I would just roll through basically all work for the semester, and I'd end up on the other side, and I did fine.
So you're using – that was an accident, right? Like you didn't purposely say, well, let me go do something fun to get me started. That's with some hindsight that's the model.
No, I don't know. That just – I don't know where I got it from. I really don't. But that's the thing, is I have to get started. And I did this every semester. This became how I got through school, or when I was faced with something hard, an insurmountable problem, I did that. And there was a lesson that I carried from that piece and applied many times in my life afterwards, is you can actually do way more than you think you can. And so it seems like if I were to say, what would I be able to do in 3 weeks' time? I'd go, oh, maybe two papers of 25 pages each with all the research. No way I could do six. No way. Right? But actually, I ended up doing all six. And I look back once I got to the other side, I'm like, huh, if I had tried to estimate or imagine what I could do, I would have way undershot what I was capable of. And it was something that forever in my life, I would always, if I thought I could do two, I would take on six, commit to six. and then go, well, I'll probably fail. But then I'd kind of do my best, and by doing my best on six, I would get far more than if I had done that for two.
And did you learn that early, or is that something
it
you
was,
learned?
It was this college thing, the shock of having to do so much work, what seemed to me so much work in college. How do I get through? I didn't do this freshman year, and my grades kind of figured it out progressively that this is what worked for me. But when I came through the end, nothing ever felt hard. And I would challenge because, man, if I could get through that and way more than I thought I could, nothing ever seemed hard. And then I would challenge myself. I would say, instead of, huh, here I'm supposed to do, like I did my master's at UCLA several years later. And normally it's a 2 to 3 year program. I'm like, I don't want to take the time and I don't have the money to be out of state for 3 years. I just don't have the money. So I want to do it in 9 months. 9 months. No one's ever done it in 9 months before, said UCLA. And, you know, the fastest ever was, you know, whatever, 18 months. And I said, will you let me try? I said, sure. And then I took it on. I was taking way more classes. You know, I did a master's thesis at the same time. I took on way more than was, you know, normal. And I go, somehow I'll figure a way through it. And I'll do my best, and maybe I'll fail. But if I fail, I'll just do it in two. But I took it on.
Okay.
Do more than I think I can. And I didn't worry about the failure. So sometimes people are afraid they might fail. And I'm like, no, there's no way I can succeed, I'm saying to myself. Mm-hmm. But I kind of believe I will. Because I can do more than I think I can. So that removes the charge.
Yeah, there you go. So the thought was, I can do more than I think I can.
Yes.
So then I need, in order for that to be true, I need to build capacity. Yes. Or I need to push some limits, right? And the way that you would build your capacity is to bite off more than you think that you can do. Because yes, it's based on the philosophical axiom that I can do more than,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
So I have to actually sign up for more than I think.
Yeah.
And you would prime your experiences with fun and vibrance and like dopamine start. Releases
get me
in some kind of way.
Get, yeah, going.
And then that would actually create some pressure to, because you're now shortening or reducing the time to get that goal done. Okay. And then that pressure you would thrive under in some kind of way as well, because you're already primed,
yes,
with the good vibes, so to speak,
right,
serotonin, dopamine, all that good stuff. And then what you're able to do is create more space by saying, if I fail, well, I signed up for more than anyone thinks is,
exactly,
possible anyways. So there's no cost to your ego, your identity, your self-esteem,
right. Right.
Based on your model. So do you have a big ego? You've had incredible success.
I do and I don't.
Okay.
I think I have a belief in myself and a confidence, mm-hmm, that I can succeed and that I'm good. You know, ultimately,
where does confidence come from for you?
So that's an interesting question. I have a belief, and it goes all the way back to my sort of philosophy of life, and you know, it goes like, why are we here, and all of this type of thing. But generally, I'm an optimist, and I believe that life is a gift. That we don't know why we're here, but it's the most, that the time we have on this earth, however it happened, it's the most precious thing we have. And the cardinal sin, the most important cardinal sin is not to waste it, right? So, and I do believe, you know, I'm not religious in any way, any typical way, but I believe there's a path, and that if the goal in life is to try to stay true to yourself, like what's really important, and to isolate it and think about it and feel, what do I need to be fulfilled during this phase of my life? And if I stay on my true path, I will be successful, right? And a lot of times people stray, or they don't think about it, or, you know, they're not optimizing to stay true to what's important. Really important, but it comes from an optimism that if I can be true, I'll stay on the path of what's meant for me, and it will be good. So I guess where does confidence come? Confidence comes from a belief that I will be successful somehow, that somehow in the universe it's meant for all of us to be successful, and our job is to figure out what is it we're meant to do now at this point, or what's important to us to do.
Okay, so brilliant. Is your philosophy about, no, I want to hear like in a sentence, because that's, mm-hmm. There's nothing you just said that I disagree with. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what are the best practices to help people find their authentic self. Mm-hmm. And then what are the best practices to help people push into their capacity? Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you're teaching me about how you push into capacity, mm-hmm. that like your model's pretty clean. Yeah. And then do you have a model or a practice or a way to figure out not only who you are, but what you're supposed to do with mm-hmm. that who?
Yeah.
Right. Do you have a way that you've...
So here's how I think about it. So life is the most valuable thing. A successful life is like a book that you can be part author to, and the universe, whatever that is, authors the rest. A book has chapters in it, and it has some continuity across. So for me, the perfect life is one where you're a different person at different stages. You know, it's not one thing. But you want to have some themes that give you satisfaction, that it's not, you know, there's a meaning, there's a purpose. I've been exploring something or interested in something over many of my chapters, and that gives a little bit of fulfillment. So the way it works for me is every time you're unhappy in life, or you're coming up to what I call a chapter change, right? Maybe you're my first one was I was graduating from undergraduate. Well, what do I do? Do I take this job? Do I, you know, it's a question, a decision. At each chapter, you know, I can tell something's going to change or has to change because I'm frustrated in my job or just got married, or, you know, there are these moments that something's going to change. What I do is I isolate the core emotion that I'm feeling, and I literally take the emotion and let it settle into my chest and feel it. And I feel it over days, like the core thing that I need. And then I work, and this is something over weeks, months, to turn that emotion, that true emotion, into words that capture that emotion and are actionable. And that's what I call a verbally stated goal. So what does this mean? Every word is important and meaningful and feels true to that emotion. And then when you have it, a phrase, a goal, you know, you then have to tell everyone you meet, this is what I'm doing, even if you have no idea how you're going to do it. And I can tell you the story of my life when I graduated from college, when I, you know, at this point, my entire life story can be in these chapter headings. And I can tell you what was important to me at that time. And I would go out and I'm at a Christmas party or whatever, and so, hey, how's it going? What are you doing? Oh, I'm doing X. This is my verbally stated goal.
Okay.
And so then you're like, I just told 100 people, I better get working on it.
So you got to back yourself into the corner a little bit.
Commit yourself to it. Yep. And then people start to help you. They say, oh, I know this guy who's doing this and that. So that two things, by stating a goal that's true, that captures the emotion, telling people about it, it gives commitment. You know, real commitment that even though I have no idea how I'm going to accomplish it, I'm going to do it.
Yes.
And then people help. And it comes back to that truth of if I had that right core emotion, I will be successful, even though it's a crazy goal. I've probably taken on more than I can chew. But somehow I believe I will be successful.
Okay. I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out.
Okay, so what are the core emotions?
It's been different at different times, so I'll give you a few of mine.
Sure.
When I graduated from college, I had all these job offer that paid well and that was in the place I wanted to be and this and that. But my grandfather could walk down the street, and I had never been anywhere in my life, but he spoke 7 languages. And it was so worldly. And I wanted a bit of my grandfather in me. I wanted some of him. Mm-hmm. And that was the core emotion. And so I translated it into the goal, foreign perspective. So that was the phrase that I said. This is what I want, foreign perspective.
And this is like chapter 5 in your life.
Chapter 1. This was my first one. Because I only figured this out. This is my first creation of this approach.
Okay.
Was right when I was graduating. How do I choose which job, or what do I do now? That became a core goal. And so I didn't choose the job with the most money, didn't choose the job in the right place. But I chose the job that might get me to France, where I could work. Once I had a goal, there were all these opportunities. And it helped guide my choice. Like, what is important to me? Is it the money? Is it the interest of the job? Or I'm like, no, I have this goal, foreign perspective. Let me try this one because that might get me what I'm seeking
I love it for so many reasons because words matter so much. Mm-hmm. They are clear representation of thought.
Yes.
And what you've done is you said, I'm using feeling.
Yes.
To help articulate the most important thought that's attached to it.
Yes.
And then I'm going to make sure that that's real for me and it's authentic. And then I'm going to put that into my conversations with other people.
Yes.
And that's going to be how I'm going to build some sort of roadmap. I don't know where it's going yet, but as long as I stay true to those 2 words or these 6 words or whatever they are for you, right, then I'm on the right path.
Yes.
So this is how you've been the architect of a path of meaning.
Yes. And I believe that somehow because if I'm true, following my true path, I will be successful somehow. And I'm the biggest skeptic in the world. Remember, I started out as a magician who won't believe any, you know, there's always a trick.
Yeah, right. There's, yeah.
So I'm a skeptic. I don't believe in fate. I don't believe in religion. I don't, you know, I'm a skeptic, but I believe in this somehow. And I know that I'm fooling myself in a way. Like I'm going, oh, I'm just telling myself the story, but it works for me. Mm. So it's a cyclical belief system in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do it. I'm successful at this goal and I'm successful at that goal. And even though I'm like, well, maybe this is hokum, it works for me and I believe it. So there's both disbelief in it and belief, but confidence that it will work out.
Skeptic or optimist? I heard both of those for you.
I'm both. I'm skeptical about most things in life. You know, if there's someone selling me something, I won't believe. You know, my wife is more of a believer than this. She'll see something, go, oh, maybe this is true. I'm like, it's not true, right? Just so I'm a skeptic, and I'm an optimist. I believe the best in people. I believe that good will happen in the world and should happen in the world, and I believe that I will be have a good life if I can stay true.
And then how many chapters have you had?
That's a good question. So they happen about, my average length is about 4 years, I'm finding. I started at 21 and I'm 50 now. So, you know, let's say 30, so maybe 8. And they've ranged from wanting to travel, obviously, far in perspective, to at one point I wanted to have a career. I thought that's what I needed to do, work for a company. And so one of them was, where could I work for 10 years and not get bored? Because I loved my job in France, but I wasn't learning anymore. And I'm like, you know, and I thought that's what I needed to do, find the place. And I was trying to conceive of that. And it was, you know, it seems silly, but it was an important question as a young man. You know, what do I want to do? Where, seriously, what's my career going to be?
I love this, Adam, because like we started the conversation about being a tastemaker. Mm-hmm. And so often we're overwhelmed by what other people, what their taste is, mm-hmm. or their preferences and how something should look or ought to look. And then we're over-indexed on the world's point of view. Mm-hmm. And what you've done is you've spent time being mindful and aware of your own yes. experience and then having the courage to carve that path. Mm-hmm. So early on in my life, I want to share something with you. Yeah, I think you'll appreciate it. Maybe, sure. Maybe not. But when I was developing my philosophy, one of the things that was really clear to me is that I had to have the courage to carve my own path. Mm-hmm. So guided by an inner spirit is what I would call, I think, the same process that you have. Mm-hmm. So how did I start it off? Be guided. Be guided by your inner spirit and have the courage to carve that path with grace, excellence, and right fucking now, right? Like there's no time other than right now to do it.
Right.
So the courage to listen and then the courage to have, you know, carve that path is really hard.
Yes.
And then I wanted to do it in harmony with excellence and then do it now and again now and again now. And that guided me for probably 15 years.
Yeah.
And then I have what I would call a version 2 of that. But so it sounds like in some ways we have a very similar approach to how we've carved our own unique experiences.
Yeah, I think that captures it, you know, really pretty well. And it's about listening to what's important to you now and realizing.
How long does that take for you?
Well, I usually know a change is coming because I'm. You know, unhappy,
agitated or unhappy and or dissatisfied.
I'm unhappy or I have a need. I'll give you a few other of these moments. One is, you know, I never needed money before in my life, but at one point I got married and I said, I'd like to have, you know, it's a goal. It's a feeling that I should be able to have the down payment for a house and the money to be able to afford to have a child. So that became like a need. And I looked at my salary at the job I was making and the house I was renting. And in Palo Alto, it was worth at the time $1 million. I'm like, where am I going to get $1 million? I have $25,000 in the bank and I'm making $75,000 a year. I don't understand how, and I don't even like the house I'm renting. Right. So how do I do that? And to have a child, we needed some medical help, and that's takes more money than I had, much more money than I had in savings. So for the first time, money was a goal, but precisely for the emotion was I want to provide, have a house and a child.
So that the money was the extension of the authentic want or desire or need that you had.
Right.
And that was, tell me if I'm wrong here, because I've got this thought that the reason people change is because of pain. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see if you ascribe or disagree. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. Like, I would like to have that honest conversation. But it sounds to me, and I don't want to back into my own model, but mm-hmm. I am, is that you had pain, awareness of that pain.
Yeah. I had a need.
Okay.
I wouldn't, in this case, sometimes it is pain. It can be frustration or mm-hmm. here was for me a need. But it was a core fundamental need. Right. Not about the money. And when I look back on my career, like that moment, so I loved my job. But if you adopt and commit to this need as really important, I can look at my job and go, there's no way. It's not supporting that goal. Right. And when an opportunity came along, which I would never have considered, when I evaluated this path or this path or this path, according to my verbally stated goals that I'm telling everyone all the time, I'm like, you know, this one leads me closer to that goal. And 1 year, you said, how long does it take? So I got married, you know, started to grow this feeling and need over maybe a year after being married, became like, man, I really should do this. Once I committed to it, 1 year to the day after, and I figured out how much money do I need in cash to have a down payment for a house. And I had a number. And so I figured it out for that. 1 year to the day, I had that number in cash after taxes, and I could put the down payment to my house. And my wife said, oh, you should have asked the universe for more. I'm like, no, that's not how it works. It has to be truthful and the core need. But, you know, it really was that fast. And that set me in, you know, it changed the vector of my life in a certain way.
How do you, when, okay, authenticity mm-hmm. and alignment, that's what I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. And then so from, I've got this model that I work from clarity to conviction.
Yes.
And
I love the word conviction.
Me too. Oh, you do? Yeah. I love that. Yeah. Because once you know who you are or the principles that you stand for most, you'll do whatever it takes mm-hmm. to be able to live authentically. Okay, so from clarity to conviction. And my challenge to want to understand from you is, once you've got that clarity and then you go out into the world and you get some no's or it doesn't work or people raise their eyebrow or whatever it is, and you're not gaining the traction that you hope that you would get, and everyone's got plans, but what do you do when they don't go according to plan? Like, how do you buffer yourself from swallowing or digesting or hearing the reality of the world?
I can't, you know, I'm just confident. And so I do think, oh, that one wasn't the one. So when I look back, if I'm true, like there are a lot of decisions you make in life and you never know, you know, should I have done the other thing, taken the other job or gone to the other path? But I really believe if I follow this process and I'm true to myself, there's no way I can't succeed. And so often, when I went to France, I didn't choose the job that, was going to pay me the most money, salary, right? But I took the one that would lead me to France. But I ended up, it turned out, working on an expense account. I was out of the country, you know, so I had $180 a day for food in Paris and for living. I was out of the country and didn't have to pay taxes on my salary. So even though I had took the lower salary job, I looked back and go, my gosh, even from a financial perspective, this was the path. That's, you know, so mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. many times if you follow the process, I just have this self-reflective kind of thing that, oh man, it's always the right path.
I love
it. And I will get there. So any little bump, sometimes what seems like a failure, you can't under for me, if you have enough confidence, it just means that that little thing that you thought was so important wasn't. It's just a temporary bump. And it can seem devastating. But when you look back, you go, oh, there's something better. Imagine a girlfriend, you know, you break up with your girlfriend, life seems like it's going to end. For if you're confident, you're like, well, that just wasn't the one. Right. So it's that kind of thing. I think if you pursue with confidence, life can't give you a failure. You just keep going and you go, that yeah, wasn't the one.
When I hear you with saying pursue with confidence, I'm actually hearing in my head with clarity. Like, mm-hmm. And I think that the three steps are connect, you've connected, then you have clarity, and then you live with some conviction, mm-hmm. right? I think it's actually three that you've mm-hmm. done. And then you have this, from that clarity, it seems like you have this perspective. Mm-hmm. And so the little bump is a little bump, even though it can feel big, and you go, whoa, 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 hold on. There's a much grander thing that I'm pursuing. Yeah. So then how does that get us to you cooking up Siri?
Yeah. So let me tell you about that chapter.
Yeah.
So I was at a job, you know, I had chosen the right path to get there. But after a little while, I grew and I had frustration. That the two emotions were, I was feeling frustrated that this wasn't going out anywhere to impact people. And I had all of these ideas that were being stifled. So I wanted to create and I wanted to get something that would matter, core emotions. So my verbally stated goal for 2007 was 5 projects that can impact users in 2007. Why 5? Do more than you think you can, right? There it comes back to you. And I would tell everyone I met, what are you doing? Hey, what's you up to? Oh, I'm doing 5 projects that can impact users in 2007. And then I'd be like, crap, I only have 2 ideas. I better get on to it, right? But so what I ended up doing, and this was from a business point, I built working prototypes of 5 different things that I was excited about. And then I could show them to people. I could get feedback on them and I could learn about them by getting in and building these prototypes. And then my verbally stated goal for 2008 was 1 major, 1 minor. So good. Out of the 5, pick 2, the best 2, make 1 my day job, make 1 my night job, and take them into the world and make them real.
And you're an engineer by trade.
Yes.
And so when you say you would build a prototype, it was a software prototype?
Software prototype.
Okay, so you're building a product, mm-hmm. and you had 2 that you liked out of the gate. You came up with another 3. You tested those out.
Well, I liked 5. I came up with 5 right, and learned about them and then chose 2 out of the 5.
Then you chose a major and a minor.
Yes.
And you would test those with people? Is that
yes.
how you get
during
feedback?
Yes. During that first year on the 5, I would show them to people. I'd go say, what do you think? I'd talk to people about them. I'd try them.
And this was artificial intelligence-based products or something else?
Not all. So okay. out of those 5 projects, 3 of them actually ended up as companies. So – in a sense, my major was Siri. So I started it as a spin out. We raised $8.5 million, built a team to go build Siri. So that was my major. My minor was another artificial intelligence company called Sentient Technologies. They've now raised over $150 million. This is 10 years later, and they're doing amazing things, helping the world. And then the third was change.org. So I had built a prototype. It's now the world's largest petition platform for good with close to 200 million members. And anytime you see something wrong in the world, you can start a petition. I want this organization or person to change this thing, and here's why. People click on it, and that, you know, you get enough people clicking on it, things actually change in the world. So in a sense, it was the most prolific time, but my core was I want to impact and I want to create. I have ideas, and it just was an explosion of get this out on paper. And all 3 of them, 10 years later, you know, Siri is probably on 500 million devices or more. Change.org is, you know, helping hundreds of millions of people, and Sentient is saving lives and doing important things in AI. You know, all of that came from one core emotion, one do more than you think you can, and then taking things forward, you know, for real in the form of companies.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something, it's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. It's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. And then how did you have the resources to build those 5? Was that, and when I think of resources, yeah. I think of the creative resource. Okay, got it. Because you were listening to yourself and from that, you were putting it into the world. And so you started, you kind of back ending the creative process for you based on your process. Okay. And then there's financial, and then there's time, and then there's people as resources.
Yeah.
So what kind of resources did you have to create those 5 that turned to 3?
So I basically did them while I had a full-time job. So I was working at SRI International.
Stanford Research Institute,
it used to be called. Mm-hmm. As my day job, I was leading one of the largest AI projects in U.S. history. It was a $250 million project over 5 years, funded by DARPA. You know, 400 people, and my job was kind of the VP engineering, deliver the system that would come out of this massive project.
And was there an aim for that project? Was there
It was called. It was about building cognitive software, so software that didn't know how to do anything in particular, but could learn on its own with no code changes how to do anything.
Was that the beginnings of machine learning?
It had huge influence. It was the largest machine learning project ever in U.S. academic research history. Funded a lot of people, and in a sense, it was kind of the mother of Siri. So you can think of Siri in some ways as a spin out of a little piece of that, but done, you know, the way I wanted to do it, as opposed to this giant monolithic, government-run project. So I had some frustrations with that original project, but the goals and the ideas were right. And I said, how would I do it? That was one of my five projects. Although it was not funded, I did it on the side. You know, Siri was not directly funded by that project, for instance.
Did you need to, like, wrestle Siri from DARPA? Or was it really clear that you did it on off hours or whatever that protocol would be?
In this case, this Siri was an SRI spin out. So that means I actually went and asked for some corporate dollars to develop it. DARPA, the way SRI works is DARPA is using public money. SRI is a nonprofit, builds research software for the government that they can use for whatever they want, but they get to own commercial rights to it.
SRI does.
Mm-hmm. So it's the Bayh-Dole Act of 1970 or something that sets it up that way.
Okay.
So SRI has the right to commercialize some of the research that it's done for the government. And so with that, we took some of the patents and some of the software. You know, it wasn't paid directly by this project, but some of the inspiration came from that project. But SRI gave money, and they helped us raise money through VCs.
Okay, so essentially SRI was your partner?
Yes, they were a partner, and they owned part of the company.
The company, okay.
Whereas the other two were completely, so Sentient and Change.org were completely my own machine, my own time, had no connection to SRI at all. And I just did them as extra. And that was part of an arrangement that I had with my boss. I was so frustrated and stifled, I said, I quit. And he goes, you can't quit. You're leading our most important project. And I said, okay, I will stay, but I need a little bit of latitude to have my own ideas on the side, won't use, you know, machines or time from the company. And he said, great.
Got it. Okay. And then can you talk about your model of influencing your product development or service development from people to people to people to machine and machine to machine? Can you walk us through that?
So I mentioned that a good life, a rewarding life, is many chapters as you change through who you are and what you need at different times, and some themes. And for me, my career themes form a triangle. And so what I say is, what am I interested in? It's these three axes. One is human to machine. How can people interact with computers in a more natural and efficient way? So Siri is an example of that. Second is human to human. How can you harness the collective intelligence of the world? You know, how can you get the entire world working together more efficiently to problem solve? And change.org is an example of that. And the third is machine to machine. If you could have millions of computers and pose to them at massive scale problems that no human could solve on their own, could machines solve those problems? And that's really was what Sentient was about. So I kind of formed these companies as along the axis of interest, but I've been doing projects throughout the decades. You know, Siri is one type of system, but I had my first version of Siri 17 years earlier than that, in, you know, early 90s, before I ever saw a web browser. I had a version of Siri where you could talk to services running on lots of computers, and I thought this was the way people would interact with remote computers. I did that whole document thing just completely passed me over in the beginning. and it's funny that now that we had went through the web piece, the notion of an assistant, meaning as a better way to execute tasks, it's not by clicking on web pages and links and filling in forms. You just tell an assistant, this is what I want to do, help me do it, and it will go to all the right providers in the world and orchestrate that for you. I think it's now coming back. A lot of companies are spending, you know, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and now Samsung are all investing billions of dollars into this vision, which I had in early 90s.
What a fun time for you.
Oh.
Like, what a fun time. Now, tell me if this is naive, but I would imagine that Siri and other AI engines that people are familiar with can do, is doing only 10% of what they can actually do. Is that a fair assumption, or is Siri maxed out? Like, and what are the other ones? What is Echo? Is it Echo?
Amazon is Echo. Yeah. Amazon Echo.
And
or
so
Alexa.
Alexa. Okay. Who's doing Alexa?
It's the same. The,
the
speaker is called Echo, but the assistant inside of the speaker is called Alexa.
Alexa. So are they at 10%, 50%? Is it scary? What if we had these things really unleashed? Like, teach me about that.
Sure. So, so they're all assistants. Today, they're kind of maxed out on today's or on yesterday's technology, right? They can all do about 30 things well. They can set a timer. They can, you know, send a message. They can tell you a sports score, look up finance, and they can return a web result. But that's about it. They only know 30 or so things. And why is it? It's because they've been programmed by one company. It's either Amazon or a Google or, you know, an Apple. And they have lots of engineers, and they type in all of the things that the system can do, and they write code, and they hook it up to back-end services. But even if they have 100 people, you know, there's only so much 100 people can do. What I'm trying to do with Viv now...
This is your new product.
My newest company, which recently sold to Samsung. And so it'll be on. Thank you. You know, I get a second chance to take my ideas and software and distribute it to hundreds of millions of people. So this next generation set of assistants, the goal is to truly open them up to the world's developers. So think of it like a website. Any company can type in a lot of pages. But it was Wikipedia that has a page for everything, so to speak, and is instantly updated by, you know, millions of people around the world on every subject, right? That's scale. It's a much bigger website than any website from one company. So what we're doing with Viv is we're going to create the world's greatest assistant as a showcase. We'll be able to do things that no other assistant can do today, but a limited number of them. But we're going to release the tools and think of it like an app store, a marketplace, where every developer in the world, every industry, every use case can be added into this assistant in a truly scalable way with the right business models and incentives. And if you have that, now you have an intelligent assistant who doesn't just know about sports scores and timers and messaging. It can know about use cases in every domain.
So if somebody has a product, a biofeedback product or a biodata management product, they can hook into your AI frame, if you will, and develop a product just for them, but then other people can also use it.
Yes, and it'll be, think of the assistant as like the new browser or the new smartphone, right? It's really the smartphone, the iPhone is like a shell, right? And you can load in the knowledge you want, the apps. Mm-hmm. Then you can do all sorts of things. Well, what I want is a single assistant, one assistant, we'll call it Viv, that you can access from anywhere, any device. So maybe from my smartwatch, if I'm watching TV, and the speaker in my kitchen while I'm driving in my car, or if I'm in my web browser, I want to be able to say, Viv, can you do this for me, or get me this, or do this, or take care of this complex task? And all the services of the world, so everyone with a website, everyone with a mobile app, their knowledge and capabilities will be part of Viv. And Viv can say, no problem, I'm going to go, you know, look up the, you know, you want the cheapest ticket to the place where your sister's getting married next month. Let me go check the calendar, find out where that is. Let me book the hotel, get you the flights. And I'm going to do that by going to the websites. So Viv will take care of applying my preferences to get the data and services that are needed and to take care of it for me.
So multimodal decision making on the fly.
Yes.
And those multimodal decision making are maybe based on preference or instructions that you would front load or give to Viv on in real time.
Yes. It's like an assistant, a human assistant. Yeah. You're going to have to, they'll have to learn about you and what you like, and you'll give them, you know, direct specific instructions. And over time you can give them more general instructions because they know the specificity.
What was the movie? Was it Machina? No, what was the movie?
Yeah, Ex Machina was one, or there was Her also that came out.
One was like a computer that was, she was started to date it. She started to date the computer. Is that Her? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that was the Ex Machina.
That's Ex Machina, not an actual physical form, but like a, So are you going down that path? Like a love relationship? You know, like are we taking it there as well?
Well, I don't think so. I hope not. Let me just say,
okay.
I believe in the old-fashioned human-to-human side for the love story, not the human-to-machine or the machine-to-machine.
Okay, so this fits on machine-to-machine and human-to-machine?
So Viv is the first project I've ever done that will unite all three corners of the triangle.
It's also human. Well, how is it human-to-human? So because the hub.
It's the world's developer. So what
That's
is it?
Okay.
There's a human-to-machine assistant interface, like a Siri.
Totally got it.
But it's built by the developers of the world, like a Wikipedia or a collaborative. How do you harness the collective intelligence of the world's developers in this case?
Yep.
And there's a lot of, in order to keep the thing running and fair without me having to get in the middle and arbitrate between different providers and what's good and what's not, you need a lot of pure automated machine-to-machine learning or intelligence to kind of orchestrate it all and keep it going so that I don't have to be making any decisions personally or our team or our company. It needs to be a fair, balanced ecosystem that runs itself, kind of like Wikipedia. You know, in Wikipedia, anyone can modify every page. Why doesn't it just all fall apart into gunk with people destroying it and putting in falsehoods? And they've set up the rules of the game such that quality is maintained. And we need to do that. But in this world, you need some machine learning to help that along.
Mm. And then do you have a time frame? Optimistic window?
It's not announced, but you know, I can tell you it will be coming soon.
I love that. And Viv is based on Vivian? Do you know a Vivian?
I don't know a Vivian. The meaning of names are kind of interesting. My son has had to live with me. You know, all of my creations have names. So I have an Iris and a Kalo and a Siri and a Viv and a, you know, so they all have kind of these human elements. So Viv comes from the Latin for life, and the idea is we're going to animate these kind of more inanimate services by adding conversational and all this assistant-like on top. So it really, it's kind of bringing to life the world's services and devices.
What keeps you up at night about artificial intelligence? What do you worry most about? What's coming next?
So there are a lot of famous people who have, you know, kind of signaled an alert that, boy, if AI progresses, it could surpass human intellectual capacity. And in certain very narrow domains, it already has. You know, it can beat the world chess champion. Watson beat the world's Jeopardy playing programs. Go, all of these kind of pillars of intellectual, you know, achievement, like chess, are falling one after another. Even poker just happened in the last month, where you have to bluff and read expressions. It doesn't keep me up at night. So people like Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking and others say, well, maybe they'll become so smart, they'll take over. That would be bad for humanity. everyone I know who works in the field realizes while we're very good at having computers solve very narrow problems, we have almost no ability to let them generalize, to let them be flexible, to take something they've learned in one area and apply it to another area. You know, the world's best chess computer can't play checkers worth a darn. Right. And doesn't know how to apply the learnings, mm-hmm. even though there's a lot of similarity. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, we believe, at least everyone I know in the field feels like we haven't even seen the spark of life. You know, there's no notion of what consciousness means. There's no intelligence, even at a level of a 2-year-old, in generality and flexibility. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe such a thing is going to ever happen in my lifetime or maybe thousands of years. Is it possible? Yes. Is it worth thinking about? You know, kind of like, boy, there's probably extraterrestrials out there somewhere, given the number of galaxies and stars. And, you know, it's unlikely we're the only place where life started. Why would we be that special? But, you know, so it's a real thing to think about. Because if we ever met an extraterrestrial, it would be bad for humanity. But it's not something that keeps me up at night because it's so remote. It's so long, you know, out there. I don't believe it's going to happen in my lifetime, my son's lifetime, or anyone.
What are you searching for?
I think, as I said, my goal is to maximize the time I have on this planet. I'm always searching for... Am I working on, you know, am I focused on the most important thing at this time for me? And if not, I need to change it because otherwise I'm wasting the most precious gift we have, which is the time on this earth. So I think that's what I'm doing. I'm really trying to make the most out of life, to do it by staying present to what's important, by developing the themes that interest me. Career-wise and family-wise and others over time. And I think that's kind of how I'm living my life.
Do you have a spiritual framework that's part of that mechanism?
Not in a formal way. I like religion as... I like the good parts of the cultural sides of religion. You know, having some rituals and get-togethers, and, you know, it makes commonness across humanity. I hate when religion divides people and is used as a negative, a divider. So I'm very skeptical about many aspects of kind of formalized religion. I have a belief system, and I do somehow feel life isn't, you know, random, but I don't really know much more than that. I don't believe in a thinking, conscious mm-hmm. God who's guiding something, you know, that seems too simple. So I don't know. It's this kind of, I have a belief and I'm not quite sure in what, but mm-hmm. that's enough for me.
And then I know we talked about your philosophy already, but is there how would you finish the statement? My philosophy is?
I don't have a quick answer. I'd say my philosophy is seek the truth and make it come true. Something like that.
Is there a word that cuts to the center of what you understand most?
I don't know. A word. I don't think I can. Maybe belief in this. You know, I have a framework.
And, yeah, you do.
And it's not really a word. It's a belief system or a way that guides me, and I think it's working well. And I'm so excited. You know, I just turned 50 this year, and I kind of believe I'll probably make it to 100, say. So I say that I've lived the first half of my life, and it's been absolutely phenomenal so far, the best I could imagine. But now I get to start all over again and create life number two, so to speak. And I'm going to, you know, take the framework that I've lived much of my life by, and I can't wait to see what it creates next. But it's like a refresh. It's like I get to restart.
I can't wait to see it.
Redream it.
I cannot wait to see which. I'm eagerly waiting for Viv.
Thank you.
And me too. Yeah, I bet you are. And I've got like one more question about AI, and then I've got a few quick hits for us. Is that on the AI piece, there was a recent, I think it was a, yeah, it was a murder or a criminal act that one of the AI systems overheard in somebody's home. And I didn't realize that they're always on and listening. They're listening for your voice to give a command. And so it picked up a murder. And like, what do you think of that? Should they release the tapes? Is that a privacy, a violation of privacy?
So I haven't heard about that. I could believe it. Mostly the systems that pick up your voice, they are listening, but it doesn't go anywhere. It's not recorded. There are no tapes.
There's no tape.
So it's literally, you know, if you say, hey, Siri, it'll turn on, or Alexa, and then you say that there's a wake word. And so they have a chip that's only job is to listen for that wake word. And it's listening, but it's not storing it or sending it anywhere. At least it should not. I don't know of any product that sends it somewhere.
Okay.
Now, once you say, hey, Siri or Alexa, then it wakes up, and now it's going to listen and process and send what you said after the wake word somewhere, because it needs to go to a server to understand it and do it.
I'm going to go find that link that I read, and you know, I'll dig a little deeper with that model and see.
So it's possible someone said the wake word, or it was mistaken as a wake word. It started listening, sent whatever you said next as an accident. The perception that it's someone is always listening and recording to everything you say.
That's not accurate.
That's not accurate to my knowledge. Maybe NSA has, who knows, but that is not good.
Okay. That is not good.
It should not be true. And it's not, to my knowledge, no company would do that.
Okay. All right. Cool. Street smart or analytical? This is you.
Analytical.
Make better decisions in fast-paced environments or slower-paced environments?
I guess I would say slower. I mean, the most important decisions, as I said, are really global, should I be doing now type decisions. And they grow, a feeling grows. Maybe I'll capture one word that's related. But it takes me time to work. It's work.
I love that.
To formulate the mission statement that's actionable, measurable, that's useful, but that captures the words.
The feeling.
The feeling, sorry.
For you, yes.
Capture the feeling, and every word is meaningful. Like when if I tell you any of my statements, like, you know, five projects that will impact users in 2007, you can't shorten it. And every word is valuable. And I've spent time thinking about those words, and each one resonates with some different part. And you can't, you know, it captures the full commitment of what I'm going to do. And I can tell you did I do five in 2007 or not? Did they impact users or not? It's actionable, measurable, and it captures that emotion, frustration, creation.
I love it. Okay. Are you a rule follower or risk taker?
I'd say rule follower more than a risk taker.
If you could be the first person to go to Mars with a 50% chance of coming back.
No.
No interest. I believe you.
Just a bunch of powder.
What is your need for control?
That's an interesting one. I'd say relatively. I'm mostly, for good and for bad, focused on myself. I don't want to be controlled by others. I want to listen to myself, follow my path, you know, have control over, you know, my, you know, I'm not going to be passive and let, you know, be led into something I don't want to do or go, you know, down. I'm not going to take a job because someone offered it. I want to be in control of myself. But I don't need to be in control of others.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to point a way. I'm going to demonstrate. I'm going to tell you what I think. Like my son, very different from me. I can give examples, but it's not about control. It's about, you know, sending a message. And I try to point. I try to demonstrate, I try to, you know, create a vision and say, this is where I think we should go. But whether people follow me or not, that's their own decision. Mm.
Are you self-critical or self-positive?
I'd say self-positive.
And under stress, do you still maintain optimism?
Yes.
Do you have a tendency to be more anxious or depressed, if there was one of the two?
I'm not depressed. I mean, I'm pretty even keel with, you know, slightly towards the, you know, I'm loving life and appreciating. I know how to appreciate every minute, and I fully, that was the first part of my lesson, which I learned earlier than the rest, how to just look around and say, this moment I will never get back. And if I'm not, you know, this is a miracle to be here. I tell my wife 10 times a day how appreciative I am to have her in my life. I don't take, and we've been together for 20 years. It's just, I know how to appreciate the moment, and I think that makes me happy most of the time, unless there's some, you know, frustration or.
Have you done any sort of mindfulness or meditation as a way to practice the ability to be present, or is this something that you've cultivated in different ways?
I have not. So it's, I remember being in high school, all of my friends were, can't wait to get out of this hellhole and get to college. That's where it's going to be great. And, you know, and a friend of mine was anxious and depressed, I think. And I said, are you having fun? He's like, no, but I'm, you know.
Later I will.
Later. It's always better later. And I'm like, you're 17, man. This is the best time of your life. You will never, I mean, college will be great too. Wow, you will never get this moment back. And that's when, by talking to my friend, I'm like, oh, man. And so I really believe if you can appreciate every moment you have, you'll have a happy life because you're appreciating the whole way along. And you know, there's up moments and down moments in a local way. But if it gets to a global not happy, you have an obligation to change it because you're wasting it, right?
Brilliant. High trust of others or low trust?
Do I have high trust mm-hmm. of others? I'm a skeptic and an optimist. Mm-hmm. I believe the good in people, but I'm skeptical yeah. of if they're selling me something or, you know, I'll be very skeptical.
And then what do you hope the next generation gets right? Knowing what you know about artificial intelligence, building companies, you know, creating at scale, change.org, like, you know, what do you hope that the next generation gets right?
I guess it goes back to the consumptive versus productive, meaning don't just sit on your butt and consume, you know, create whatever that producing, you know, whether it's creating music or, you know, toys or artificial intelligence creations. You know, I see a generation who, you know, in my son's age, who are just watching a lot of screens being come at them. The news is coming at them in little bits. And I think it washes over them and they get a little peace, but they're not having to do that mindful creation work. And I hope that either it's not true or that they get it right and really, you know, take an active role in creating and producing things. Mm.
I want to know when's the last time you saw mastery in action, but first I want to start with how do you articulate or think about the concept of mastery? And if you want to be so bold to take a stab at defining it, but how do you think about mastery?
So I have mixed feelings about the word mastery. Mm-hmm. I love your title of finding mastery. So, you know, for me, mastery is achieving a certain level of skill, you know, a high level of skill. But it has a negative to me that, you know, like I have mastered the ability to eat with a fork. In the beginning, I didn't, right? It was hard. I had to actually think about the mechanics and figure out how to do it. But now that I've mastered that, I don't think about it anymore. I kind of coast. It's like I'm on autopilot. I've mastered how to drive. I can drive along the highway with almost no cognitive load. So for me, the people who are peak at the top of their game, if you ask them, they would say they haven't mastered anything, right? And it's the finding mastery. Like, it's, if mastery is this, you know, still putting it out there and this unreachable goal, but you're doing the more than you think you can, but you're heading towards it, it's the finding that's important. And once you achieve mastery, it's kind of disappointing because now you can do it in your sleep because you've mastered it. Whatever that you're so good at it, you don't have to work anymore. And so I guess for me, mastery the word as an ideal to find or to head towards or to want to achieve is a great thing. Like, you want to get to your goal, I guess is how I would put it. But once you achieve it, it's kind of now it's not all that you cut out to it. And now you can plateau. And so Mai said, well, go master something else. Go find another goal to work on.
I so appreciate what you just said, because the two words are really important, I think. Yeah. It's the find. It's not being a master. That's three words. It's not.
Achieving mastery.
No, it's
finding.
It's finding it, and it's the process of becoming a mastery of self and mastery of craft. It's that evolving process where we get to explore the nuances of the understanding and the nuances of the ability. And I'll tell you what, like, for me, it's bottomless, it's topless, whatever way you want to look at it. And I love that. I love how you just put the conflict of the stopping of mastery as opposed to the action of being able to continue it. So, you know, and then when's the last time you saw mastery?
When's the last time I saw mastery? Mm-hmm.
Or witnessed it, maybe yourself or somebody.
Well, last night.
What was it?
You know, I'm a huge basketball fan. So when I think of mastery, one of the highest forms of skill is basketball. It's one of the, you know, it's the best athletes doing things that are nearly impossible. And, you know, a couple years ago, Stephen Curry of the Warriors was the MVP. And then he went over the summer and he came back so improved. He could have been the reigning MVP and most improved player, right? So he clearly didn't think he had achieved mastery. Somehow during a summer where he's traveling and doing this, was frustrated enough to work on his game more, even though he was named the best player in the league. And then he won it again and was the first unanimous MVP. So last night, the Warriors' third quarter, they went on a 28-2 run. I don't think I've ever seen in my decades such cohesive mastery where an entire team was playing to near perfection for a span like that. So for me, that's an example of mastery. But I like that, you know, even the best don't think they have achieved it, I believe, because they're still working on their game. They're still hungry to improve.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you for the thoughtfulness and sharing an authentic and true expression of who you are and where you've come from. So I'm grateful for the time we've spent.
Yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. And then where can people find out more about what you're doing or what you're up to? Where's the place for us to follow along on your journey?
I have a website, so you can go to adam.cheyer.com, C-H-E-Y-E-R. And it's nothing much, but that's probably the best place to find me.
Brilliant. So for everyone listening, thank you for your time. We are honored that you're paying attention to the path and the process of becoming. And if you want to follow along, you can follow Adam on his website, adamcheyer.
That's right.
.com.
adam.cheyer.com.
And you can also go to change.org, follow along the change-making experiences and be part of that. Yep. And then keep your eye on Viv.
Yeah, right. And Viv.ai.
Viv.ai. Brilliant. Yes. And then also you can follow me on @michaelgervais.com on Twitter. And then on Instagram is @findingmastery. Punch over to our website, findingmastery.net. And then we have a community, Adam. Would you be open to answering a few questions if we post a few questions on that community?
Sure, would love to.
Yeah, they're phenomenal. It's like thousands of people that are supporting each other on this path of mastery, and they ask hard questions.
Yeah, that's how you learn, right? That's the people to people. It's, you know, That's lifting each other up. That's how to do it.
It's amazing. And I'm listening, like in the background of our conversation, I know that we've got this other app, or not app, what's it called? Podcast called Minutes on Mastery. And it's little bite-sized nuggets and pearls of wisdom. They're just not in context, but they're pearls of wisdom. And you just dropped about 15 of them. So we're going to have lots of content there too.
Great. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.